from Nashville, Tennessee. This is Keep Asking, the weekly podcast that helps you dive in a bit deeper and wider into the research providing insights into today's church and culture. Hello and welcome back. This is Lizette Beard and I'm here with Scott McConnell and our very special guest today, Bob Smetana. Bob is a writer with our communications team here at Lifeway, but he is also a world-renowned religious writer. I've heard people say you're one of the best in the country.
I have lots of good friends who lie.
But
I am world famous.
Oh, I do not doubt that. So real quick, Bob, what's a religion writer?
So a religion writer is somebody who writes about religion, religious practice, religious. So it can be anything. It can be someone inside a religious institution that covers them, or it can be a journalist at a for-profit publication or non-profit secular publication, just writes about everything from the ideas behind religion to the nitty-gritty practice to the arguments over money to the institutional politics, and then how religion affects all the different aspects of our lives.
So you've written on not just the Christian faith, but you've written on a wider variety?
Yeah, so Christians, Muslims, Jews, Sikhs, people who worship fairies, cat cultists. That's one of my favorite ones. That's most of them. Pretty much every religion. Jews, Jains, Sikhs.
All right. So since we're beginning to repeat a few.
Did I get Sikhs? No, Jains and Sikhs are different.
No, but I think you hit Sikhs. Yeah. I was just giving you a little bit of a hard time.
So pretty much every, and then people who don't believe, because they have they still have practices or they have views about religion.
So as a religion writer, how is that approach different than just a sociologist that's kind of describing an aspect of society?
It's a lot like that. I mean, you just sort of, but you're telling stories. You're not data-driven, you're story-driven.
Gotcha.
The data helps reinforce the story, so you want to know, like, how. So say you're going to write about a particular sect of people. Like, I remember being in the newspaper, wanted to write about the Baha'is. Well, do we have any Baha'is in Nashville? When I worked here in Nashville, how many Baha'is are there in the country? Are there enough Baha'is for us to really pay attention to? So, describing, it's more like anthropology, sociology, and then the hard news, you're looking at their money and their finances and whether sometimes you're looking at, here's their ideals and do their ideals match up what they actually practice. But, you know, you're describing it, you're not really endorsing it or you're not trying to win. So I used to tell people, I get to write about people and talk to people about God all day long. I never had to win. Now, if somebody's being a crook, you could say, or being abusive, that is where you kind of draw, you do take a sort of a, well, you describe what they do and where does it fit in ethics and is this harmful? But, you know, it's always hard. So there's kinds of religions that are harmful and there's kinds of religions that might be dangerous. So I've covered snake handlers, Pentecostal snake handlers. That's kind of a dangerous faith, but it's like, they're like the, you know, ultimate, they're like the base camp jumpers of religion, right? They're doing something that's dangerous, but it's not, is it harmful or not? As opposed to someone who's like an abusive cult leader who's molesting people and stealing their money.
Right.
So this is immediately taking a different turn than a lot of our other podcasts.
Yeah, but, you know, how helpful is that in terms of mentality for a ministry leader to be thinking about, you know, how can I be open-minded and learning without always trying to win in that investigation?
Yeah, so there's a lot of it. People will tell me what they think God's telling them, and in general, I just say, okay, that's what you think, God. And I'll describe. This is what you let people describe in their own words what they heard, what they think. Because did God tell them that? I don't know. Now I can ask them, how does this fit with your religious ideas and your practice? How do these statements fit with this behavior? But I'm not trying to tell you whether any group is right or not, what particular interpretation of the Bible or whatever holy book or what kind of behavior is right or not, but I can say, here's what they say, here's how they interpret it differently. You know, does this measure up to what they promised?
And this is a because of just the nature of the job, it's a different posture than a lot of our listeners who are in ministries, nonprofits, and advocacy groups or pastors of churches. So, you know, it's a little bit of a different angle, and we're going to talk to Bob about his approach when he's approaching a big story and how, you know, what research is involved there. One observation I had when I went to the Religion News Writers wingding you have every year.
The association, yes. Association convention.
Yes. And I sitting there at a table at one of the meals with so many writers from around the country, and I realized because of the nature of what you do and your posture of learning and asking questions instead of always telling, I mean, you're retelling the story, but the scope of what they understood was mind-boggling as far as nuances among denominations and then also how those fit in the picture with other religions. And it because they had asked so many questions, they had asked so many different groups, you know, and it was something I don't necessarily hear a depth and breadth, maybe breadth is the right way to say it, a breadth I don't necessarily hear from my seminary friends.
So I like to tell people, it's like if you're a sports writer, it'd be like covering baseball, basketball, or say the Major League Baseball, the NFL, the NBA, the NHL, Major League Soccer, and then lacrosse and cricket.
That's good.
And all the small things, because you need to know all the kind of – but that's the great part about it. Like so many people see – and the nice part is that so many people don't see outside of their own – not just their own – say Christians – how many Baptists know how the Church of Christ operates, or the Catholics, or the Methodists, or the African Episcopal Methodists, or the, you know, Free Will Baptists versus the United Baptists, or the United Pentecostals, or all these different kind of groups have different, they all have the same, they have some similarities, a major doctrine, but their practices are all so different in the way that they see, like Baptists are real big on the autonomy of the local church, so nobody can come in. But other groups have a bishop who can come in. But the bishop doesn't always have as much power as you think he has. Sometimes they think they got more power. And in Baptist life, there are people who got more influence than other people. So there's all these nuances of it. So it's great because there's always something really crazy that you didn't know. And crazy, I mean crazy in a good way. Something
right.
Awesome
right.
You didn't know. One of the things that I did find, when you asked before, kind of what, you know, how do I approach this differently? One thing, I'm always willing to report what people say. I'm also always skeptical. Like, I'm the worst person in church because the pastor's telling me a story, and I'm going, that's not true. Like, I'm always down there. I'm fact-checking their sermon. Like, our pastor used to always tell these stories. He had this crazy story about Winston Churchill being saved as a boy by some guy and then paying for him to go to school somewhere and then inventing penicillin. And I'm like, that is just crazy and it's not true. So, in fact, and in another angle, we used to do every year this season to give thing. It's every newspaper does it. It's like seasonal around Christmas time, give money to help people out. And for a while, every time I did something, they were all crooks. You know, every charity I was looking at, they're crooked. So I hate doing it. So anyone says that our charity does blah, 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 you can go look at their tax returns. It's called a 990 financial tax return. You can ask them to, like, prove that they're doing what they say they do. Because people are often aspirational in their claims of the aspects of their charity, and they know they were interested in a donor experience. So they want you to feel really good about giving to whatever XYZ charity or ministry or whatever it is. And then you got to say, okay, where's your outcomes? You can listen to the hard part, but you also say, okay, how many people did you really help? Did you really help those people? How much are you paying your people? Are you being a good steward of the money that I'm going to give to you? Because people lie all the time. They're aspirational about what they're able to accomplish, and they can't really accomplish it.
When you mentioned some of the groups that maybe the cults or the you know, unique followers or groups that stand out. How do you come across? I mean, you've had a couple of doozies in the past couple of years. How do those come about where you get the idea? When do you know you've got a story? And when, how do you approach something so big that can cross multiple states, you know, hundreds of people or at least 50, 60 people, you know?
So, I mean, it's all, sometimes I went to the grocery store. This is what happened. I went to the grocery store and the grocery store, they had this, let me tell you one, the cat cult. So I went to the grocery store and there was this trailer there. It was one of these pet adoption things, you know, and it's called Eva's Eden. And it kind of had this creepy cat, like Egyptian thing on the thing. And my daughter had gone to one of these and like, you go in and play with the cats. And we're like, no, we're all allergic to being a cat. And I'm like, that's weird. Like, what's going on with that? That's weird. And then I had done a story on another group. There was a group here in town in Franklin that was very a cult of personality, and the pastor was very abusive, and it had been funded by a very well-known Christian worship song. And so I'd written about that. And so then on Facebook, somebody said, hey, oh, I saw this thing about this cult, this Wayne Jolly cult. You know, there's another cult in Columbia, Tennessee, and they had a page. Is there a cult in Columbia, Tennessee? I went, oh, is there a cult there? And they're like, it's the cat people. I'm like, no, I know who they are. So then you just go, hey, would you want to talk to me about your experience? And then you just little by little unfold what happened. And then every group has a angry ex-member. So you have to make sure, what is angry ex-member? But angry ex-members often have collected all the sermon tapes and the writings. And so you just kind of like unpack that. But, you know, it's everywhere.
And some of them get TV shows.
Some of them get TV shows. And sometimes once you get into the business, people send, like, Wayne Jolly, which is this group called The Gathering, which is funded by this worship song, basically. Kind of a proceeds from that really built this cult. I'd known about them, like, 4 or 5 years earlier. Somebody sent me some material, and then they didn't want to talk. And so I was like, there's something there. I don't know what it is. Then somebody just called me out of the blue, said, hey, do you know about Wayne Jolly? I was like, yes, I do. Would you tell me about him? So you find them. We did a story about a group here in town called Souls for Souls. They're a shoe charity. They give away shoes. Mm-hmm. And they're a very reputable group now, do a lot of great work. But in their older days, they were doing some crooked things. So their first founder was misleading the public. So they would get these donated shoes, right? They give away free stock. They would get like overstock shoes from companies. Like when they changed the model, they would get these free like Nikes and stuff.
Right.
Give them away to kids overseas. Great, great idea. Well, then they would also collect all these used shoes. And they'd be like, and I thought, that's terrible, right? Why would you, like, if I could get like a brand new Michael Jordan's or I get my daughter's, you know, worn out shoes, I would be really terrible, right? If I'm some kid, I got no shoes. Look, he got Nikes and I got, you know, these kind of things with a big hole in them. Well, they were basically selling all these shoes to finance the CEO's, the used shoes to finance the CEO's kind of extraordinary salary. And they were using the donated shoes. They were valuing them really highly to boost their bottom line. So they didn't really have much cash coming in, but it looked like they had a lot of cash going in. They go, oh, we're a $50 million operation. And look, so I should be paid like a $50 million operation.
Oh, wow.
$3 million operation. So now actually about a year after we did that, they put this, right after we did it, they had a big campaign to tell us how terrible we were and awful and blah, 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 blah. Then a year later, the new guy comes in and goes, hey, everything you said was right, and here's how we fixed it all. So now they great work. They really do nice, do lots of good work.
So how do you, what are some of the strategies you use to know that you're getting the full story? You're not just running down one track. You know, how do you approach that when you start with that hunch or that first indication, but then you're making sure you're putting all the pieces together?
So first thing I do is there's a writer named Studs Terkel. He was an oral historian. Kind of, he did a book called Working. It's his most famous work. He's got a Pulitzer Prize. He died. He's kind of an old socialist, but in a radio voice. Went to his house. He did a story. He had a great story. He had a great book on what people believe in life, the end of life and life after death. It's called Will the Circle Be Unbroken? It's a great book. So I got to interview him in his house, and he's like an old socialist. Like, hey, would you like a martini? Oh, wait. No, you work for a Christian publication. Here's some apple juice. Here's the best apple juice ever.
It was great.
And he had, it was great because he was like, I'm agnostic. That's a lazy atheist, you know? But then by his window, he had this beautiful, like, vase of flowers and a little jar, an urn with his wife's ashes. And he bought her, they'd been married for years, and he bought her new, you know, fresh flowers every week, put them by there. But he was like, I don't believe in that stuff, you know, this life after death, blah, 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 blah. But then he had like this really tender, like, you know, moment. So I go, anyway, so he basically talked about prospecting. You throw a bunch of stuff in a hopper and you kind of sift it out and you get all the kind of nuggets out. So you have to put a lot of input in. So you talk to everyone and you kind of probe them. You know, is this what happened? And then you find out more and you go back and ask them again. And then you look at, in this case, this one group I looked at, this Wayne Jolly group, they filed tax returns. They didn't have to, but they had a crooked accountant who filed tax returns for them because he was charging a lot of money for them. So then they reported all their money, which was great. We could track their money. But you just keep – you look like look for documents. You look for first kind of primary sources. Mm-hmm. You listen to a lot of sermons. You go and see, and you don't presume that you know the answer. To late in the thing. Because if you go and you say, I know this person is crooked, I'm going to prove they're crooked. You go and you say, what is going on here? Because often what's going on here is more, is bigger. So there's a great story. I know I can talk forever. There's a great feature story called Old Man Peters. And it was by a guy named Wilk Peters. He's a retired librarian. One of the first Pulitzer Prizes for feature writing. So he was a church volunteer, basically. Old African-American man. Retired librarian, got this prize for helping out travelers because he spoke like six languages. And so in Baltimore, whenever somebody got in trouble at the airport, they'd call him because he knew all these languages, Mr. Peter. So some news agency does a story about him. Wilk Peters, great, you know, gets this award for being volunteer of the year, basically. And so this feature writer goes, you know, this is in the 80s. This guy's 70 years old. He grew up around the turn of the century and is the son of a sharecropper in the South. How does he end up learning six languages? Because that's, you know, if you grew up like, I can't remember, it was Mississippi, Louisiana. But if you're from that area and your dad was a sharecropper, you're not exactly, that wasn't a great place to get a lot of academic training.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it turns out he had dropped out of school and gone back to school in his 20s, gone back to grade school, and had this great life. And learning languages was a way for him to escape this very difficult past he had. And
this guy
wrote a whole long story about all the twists and turns of his life and won the Pulitzer. So he won a Pulitzer for writing about a church volunteer. But the first person who wrote about him went in and said, oh, this is just a story about a volunteer. Nice little story. I'm only going to invest about an hour of time, and then I'm gone. This other guy invested more time because he was more curious about, wait, why are you doing this? How did you end up here? And because he was curious, he had to ask more questions, and he found treasure.
That's great.
I mean, these are some great principles just for learning.
Right.
I mean, the fact that you're always curious, you're always skeptical, you're always networking, talking with people, sifting through, as you said, you know, that could be a nugget later. Let me remember that. Let me hang on to that. And that cat might show up again. You know, I think, you know, while a number of the examples you gave, kind of the exciting ones are when, you know, you caught somebody doing something wrong, but obviously you've written a lot on just, you know, how people's faith is impacting their lives and you know, how different faith movements have spread and the like. And so I think, you know, for ministry leaders, you know, that learning component should be really helpful. Talk a little bit more about kind of the communication end of being a journalist, being a writer. You know, what are some of the things that make that communication compelling and really gets across the point you're trying to make and what you feel like you've really discovered?
Well, one of the things is that something's got to be at stake. You have to figure out, like, what is... So a great story has a compelling figure who overcomes some kind of obstacle and came out the other side, right? So somebody's faced, you know, difficulty or challenges, or they saw a problem, they fixed it. That's, some kind of narrative arc. Always helps. And then people just don't know. Like, there are people who have great stories in every church. There's people who overcome, you know, come from very difficult backgrounds. They probably do in their work, they're probably doing world-changing stuff, and you never know anything about them. Or they've had great testimonies and stories in their lives, but you find out when they call the newspaper, they tell you about the bake sale. Like, I remember. So I remember this. So there's a guy in.
That's fantastic.
So out east, I'm a big Red Sox fan. Out east, there's a charity called the Jimmy Fund, which benefits the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And Dr. Dana-Farber, back in the early days, he always called every kid Jimmy. So they had this kid on the radio named Jimmy with one of the baseball teams. And they said, oh, Jimmy's he's got leukemia. We want to help him. You got to give him money. So people gave money. And then this first Jimmy, like, disappeared. Nobody knew who he was. They thought he had died because everyone was dying of cancer back then. Well, it turns out he had gone, you know, gotten better, went back. He was from New Sweden, Maine, up near the Canadian border, and been a truck driver in New Sweden, Maine, his whole life. Then a few years before he died, someone went and rediscovered him. Like, oh, wait. Because his sister, I think, had seen a thing, story saying, oh, and the first Jimmy died. And his sister was like, no, he's not. He's up in Maine. So ended up coming down and meeting Ted Williams and having this great time. Well, I worked for a denominational magazine early in my career. And he went for the Evangelical Covenant Church. And he went to the New Sweden Covenant Church. Did anyone in the New Sweden Covenant Church happen to tell us about this guy? Not until he was dead.
Oh.
Right? So I wrote his obituary. And it was like, for our magazine, we wrote a long obituary about him. And I was like, if someone had just called us, we could have had this story.
Wow.
But we didn't, because they would call us about the bake sale. We have the bake sale. We have this, you know, someone who's missionary, someone who, you know, discovered the cure for whatever, someone who did all these great stories. Well, we don't hear anything about it. But, you know, the bake sale. We'll tell you about the bake sale.
Do you think maybe sometimes in communities of a faith, the reality and the ragged edges of story, people are trying to avoid those? Or is it just a lack of curiosity because folks just aren't pursuing stories? So that's someone else's job?
So I think some of the ragged edges of it, like, it's, and I think people just don't realize, like, all the awesome things that have happened around them because they don't think it's important. Because it's like, oh, it's just so-and-so, it's Miss Susie with her story. They don't think about, oh, that's really pretty cool. And look at how this faith impacted someone's life. We should tell this story. So I remember this one church did a great job. They got a writer to write everyone's little, or they collected like first person autobiography stories of everyone in the church, and they put a nice little book together. It was all these great stories, all these things, difficulties people had had, sort of really amazing experiences they'd had, or diverse experiences they had. People grew up all over the world, you know, and they just put it together in a little book, and it was just amazing.
Wow.
But people just didn't know, because that's just so, you think, because it's so easy. We only get to church once a week, right? Or maybe twice if you're special like Lizette. Right?
And nope. That's because she was lost.
You get an hour, but you meet someone, you go, that's the person. This is Scott. He's, you know, from Philadelphia. He's kind of, you know, very neat and tidy. And
neat and tidy.
You know, he does research. He probably does, who knows what he does in his whole life he's been through. But you don't know because you only see him for a little bit, and you've already got a picture of the box that
right.
they're in.
What would you do if you saw Scott wearing a pair of jeans with a hole in the knee?
You'd go, who was that guy? What if you, like, maybe he's base jumping. Maybe he's right. jumping off buildings. But, you know, he's probably got all kinds of things that have happened in his life. But you think of him in the box. Oh, this is so-and-so. In this box, we know him for about a week. We don't know each other very well. So part of the thing is you need to know your congregation well. If I was a pastor, which I would not be because I'd be terrible at it. But if you were, you want to know people. And what is your story? Because the best thing you can do is listen to people. That's the best gift you can give to anybody, is to listen to their story and say, you really matter. Tell us about your experience. Because most people think their experiences, because it's just them, it's like, I just went through that.
We're going to have to wrap up, but I want to ask one final question. We've got other questions that we could talk to you about, so we will have to do this again. But one of the things that I've heard described about you is that that you do give a really fair treatment when you're doing stories, and you don't necessarily, and this is what others say, not just what you've told me, but you're not always going to play, I didn't realize I'd turned that on. Okay, Mike, I'll have to back up and start asking that again. One of the things I've heard said about you is that you don't always reveal all the gotchas, you know, that you could in a story when you're writing. you know, you may be revealing some things that are difficult or challenging, you know, whether it's for a cult or just for someone in a denomination, a ministry, a church, a pastor. But why is it in a world of journalism that sensationalism is very exciting? If you know that you have something and you have these facts, why do you hold back on some gotchas?
One, because I probably got too many of them. Like, you can only go. And then, like, why pile on people and grind them? Like, I know people that like to just grind people into the dust. Like, they take down some pastor, then he loses his church, and then they follow him around. It's like, oh, so-and-so, they went, you know, they got asked to speak somewhere. Oh, let's grind them down. You know, like, what's the point? I'm not trying to win anything. I'm trying to help people. And what you do as a journalist, you try to hold up a mirror and let's see the world. Let people see themselves. You want to see themselves. And sometimes people say something, they say something awkward, or they say something that comes across wrong. They might say that, right?
Right.
So we've had that recently in the news. Someone said something kind of awkward.
I think we've had that a lot in the news.
Yes. So. And so do you go and say, oh, see, this means, or do you go back to the person and say, did you really mean this? And if they say yes, and let me tell you about it, awesome. But if you don't, then why should you?
And you mean awesome not because they think crazy thoughts, but because,
no, because
they're
okay,
verifying.
Oh. We're verifying that what you said is true. Because people, they're human. And especially if you're not, not if you're a cult leader and you're stealing people's money, then we're going to report that.
Right.
But they're still a human being. And you want to treat people with, plus people can only take so much. That's the hard part of, like, so you look at whether you're talking about an investigation or data from a research or whatever, people only have so much bandwidth. You have to say, like, okay, when it boils down to it, this, this, and this, because they can get that. If you have, it's this 15 things. So if you have a, say you're writing a letter to the editor, you want to complain about something. If you write the 15 things that person did, you know, that's terrible about whatever, no one's going to listen to you. If you say, hey, here's my main point, here's what's going on. And then the other part is you want to have some kind of, like, common decency. Like, you could ruin people for a few clicks. Eh, you know, there's always somebody else who's going to do something terrible I can get a few clicks off of. Like, I can write. I mean, it's all terrible. Like, and I, you know, plus you have to know what's a good story. And how do you tell a good story? So I'll tell you one last story. So I got this call one day, and this my friend Chad Sisk, who now works for the local radio station, it's like, this guy called you. You should call him back. He has this story about 666 and his job, and I don't know, but you should call him. And I call him. He goes, hello, you're a religion man. He said this Russian accent. Oh, I must talk to you. And he had this story. He kept getting 666, and he was a Pentecostal Russian immigrant. On his badge, on his W-2 form, on the thing he had to, on his time clock, his number was 666. He's like, I can't do this, right? This is like, he go to his boss and go, I can't have 666 because, and he had this deep Russian name, and he's bald, and he was just great. The minute I talked to him, like, this is a great story. But then it was like, and I called the company, I'm like, hey, you keep giving him 666. Like, no, he didn't. Then the guy calls me back. He goes, oh, wait. When I said, no, we didn't, I meant, yes, we did. And we don't know why we keep doing it. So then it was like, okay, I got this guy on video, and I've got him telling me the story. And people read that. I mean, people, it's been in, you know, the Ukraine and India and all over Africa. Everyone in the world's read the story. But what was great was to, like, say, okay, how do you say, like, something that sounds a little extreme, and explain what was it about this principle. Like, this is a belief, and he kept getting it, and he couldn't stay because then he felt he was betraying God. So to treat him fairly while also saying there's a little bit of sensationalism in this story, and it's kind of cool and awesome, and you'll read this because it's really interesting. Because people's religious beliefs are really interesting. So religion is weird, right? Every bit of religion is weird. This is one thing I think churches don't get. If I tell you, you should, you know, follow, this Bible is really true. And we really know because this bush told this guy to go rescue his people and it was on fire. Some bush in the desert, go rescue my people and have the Exodus. You'd go, a bush told you to do that. That's like, but that's weird, right? But we read in the Bible, we go, oh, okay, this is part of God's story and it feels normal to us. The kinds of things that feel normal to us are people not raised in our faith don't feel normal about. God spoke to me. Say God spoke to me. Like, how did that happen? And usually we say if you hear voices, there's something wrong with you. So I think we have to realize how weird our own religion is and how it doesn't always make sense to other people. And so if people don't understand in us, that maybe it's just they don't understand, not that they're like hostile to you. Maybe they just don't understand what you mean when you say that. Because all those words you say, when I say God told me to do this, I mean a whole bunch of things. You know, I mean, this, I felt like this is God's will. I was reading the Bible. I prayed about it. Most of the time, for me at least, God does not say, Bob, memo, dear Bob, today go do this thing. Go work for Facts and Trends magazine and become a religion writer.
But you have gotten a song called Dear Bob.
I do have a song.
But we can't divulge any of that.
No, we can't divulge anything. But I would just say this is all, I love what you guys do and the data. The data part of this, what you asked about the data before.
Oh, we'll do that as another one.
We'll talk about it later. So come back. This is a wicked awesome podcast. You should really listen and tell all your friends because it's so much fun. Okay, just between you and me. It's awesome.
All right. So, Bob, how can people find you on Twitter?
At Bob Smetana.
And you want to spell your last name for
me? Smetana.
And following Bob on Twitter is it's like an encyclopedia of knowing what's going on in religion and faith. And it's also just a window into some random retweets. And so Bob has set the tone for retweet does not equal endorsement. There's no way you could pin him down to that because he just takes you on a wild ride, but an informative. Scott, you said that's one way that you get a lot of your
information. It's almost like a clipping service. But Bob does a great job of finding cultural and religion things. And yes, some Boston sports.
And a lady today who swims under the ice without like an air. Do you see those photos?
No.
She breaks a hole in the ice and swims in like freezing water in like Finland. And they take pictures of her. It's like beautiful pictures. It was cool. But I'm like, that's crazy. She's like, okay, put my sweatsuit under the ice. And some guys down there apparently were taking photos. Like, it's gorgeous. You should go see it.
Real quick before we wrap up, Bob, how are you doing since Peyton Manning's retirement? I know that you took that pretty hard.
Who? Hey, did you know the Patriots? We were talking about this earlier. Like, it's less than 1%. The Patriots had less than 1% chance of winning the Super Bowl. 5 Super Bowls. How many times has Peyton been to the Super Bowl? 4. How many did he win? Twice. And once he won because Rex Grossman was playing the opposite quarterback. I mean, come on. People love Peyton Manning. Yeah. Okay. Tom Brady, greatest quarterback ever. 5 rings. Ain't nobody got it.
Next time, we'll maybe divulge. We'll talk a little bit about the excellent job in researching the NFL did in Deflategate and how they went and fully researched that. I can't believe I didn't even get a reaction there.
Yes,
all right.
They did. That was awesome. They found out that it gets cold, the balls get smaller.
All right. Thanks for listening. You can contact us at S. McCon and at Lizette Beard. And we hope to catch you next time on Keep Asking.